Deal me in.
The water began to boil behind me, and I poured in the pasta and gave it a quick stir, then slid into the chair across from my grandfather as he counted out 26 cards for each of us.
Quite a storm we had this afternoon, wasn't it?
He said absently as he dealt. I bit my lip. I didn't want to talk about it. I wasn't ready yet to confess to him that I felt guilty for how I'd lost it down there, for how I'd attacked my grandmother.
You know, we get pretty intense storms around here all summer long. Break off our tomato plants, blow the barbecue grill to the other side of the porch. One time we had hail so big it busted out the skylights.
I picked up my cards. What was he getting at? He gathered his cards and leveled his gaze at me. He didn't look angry, but he did look serious.
We've never once had a tornado here. In all my 62 years, not one.
I understood what he was getting at, that I needed to let go of my fears because the chances of ever being in another tornado were so slim. The devastation in Elizabeth was unexpected for a reason, because tornadoes as huge as ours almost never happen. It was a freak accident, losing my family. That fact didn't make it suck any less. But the chances that it would happen again were almost zero, and I couldn't keep living my life expecting tragedy around every corner.
You said you learned how to play in the service, I said, trying to change the subject. Were you ever in a war?
It's a long story, he said. But yes.
And maybe it was because playing cards relaxed me, or maybe it was because I felt guilty for what I'd done to my grandmother. Or maybe I had finally gotten so lonely, so sick of my thoughts being my only company. I suddenly wanted to talk.
I've got time, I said.
So he proceeded to tell me about the Vietnam War, where he was a young private, barely out of high school, scared for his life. He told me how he'd felt insanely homesick, and how every cross word he'd ever uttered to anyone he loved plagued him as he watched young men dying around him every day. He said he'd lie awake at night and replay all the good times and bad that he'd had with his family, hoping that if he died, they'd only remember the good. He'd never had a girlfriend before he got enlisted, and he worried that he'd die over there and never know what it was like to fall in love.
That was the worst, he said. I would rather have had someone to love and left her too soon than die never knowing love at all.
He let that sink in while we flipped cards over.
But, he said with renewed vigor, turned out I wasn't supposed to find Patty before I went. I met her the day after I got home. Can you believe that? The day after.
I rooted through my cards, then drew a 9 that I needed and laid it down.
Why didn't you talk to my mom again? I mean, after she split up with Clay?
My grandfather drew a card and studied it.
I wish we had,
was all he said. There was a sizzling sound as the pot of water boiled over. I jumped up to stir it and turned the flame down, absently setting my cards on the edge of the table. They fell off with a whisper, spreading themselves across the linoleum floor. I calmed the overflowing pot, then went down to my knees to pick up the cards, which had fanned underneath a side table. That's when I noticed it for the first time. A porcelain kitten, tucked away on a low shelf. I picked it up and turned it over in my hands, forgetting about the cards as I stood up. It was a glossy orange and white tabby, with a number 3 on its chest, pawing at a purple butterfly. I held it out to my grandfather, feeling like someone had stolen my breath.
Where did you get this? I asked.
He frowned at it over his glasses in the same maddeningly nonchalant way he did everything.
That? Oh, I think it belonged to Christine. Her mother bought her one for her birthday every year. Christine loved cats. She treasured that collection. She left the whole thing behind.
He took the kitten out of my hand and looked it over.
Your grandma packed them all up and put them away. All except this one. She keeps it out because it was Chrissy's favorite.
He set the statue on the table between us.
My eyes felt riveted to it as pieces of my life snapped into place.
You'd better tend to that pot, he said. It's fixing to boil over again.
I walked over and took the pot off the stove, then searched until I found a colander and drained the pasta, stirred in the cheese and butter and milk. But I did these things on autopilot. In my mind, all I could see was a padded manila envelope, one each year, sitting on our old kitchen table back in Elizabeth.
It's another kitten, I'll bet, I could hear myself say excitedly, a birthday girl waiting for cake and presents.
I could see the sour look on my mother's face as she watched me tear open the envelope year after year. I'd always assumed she'd looked so sour because they had come from clay. I'd always assumed that was why Marin never got one. But how could my mom tell me? How could she tell me they were from the grandparents she'd raised me to believe were so mean? How could she admit that they weren't absent after all, but were reaching out to me in the only way they knew how? On second thought, how couldn't she tell me these things? How could she be so stubborn? How could she be the cruel one? Because she'd never in a million years thought I'd find out. That was how. She'd never have guessed that one day I would be playing spit with her father at the kitchen table she'd grown up eating on. Whatever grudge match had occurred between them, she'd never thought I'd learn about it. I took a bowl out of the cabinet and spooned in some macaroni.
You got any extra? I'm not really in the mood for peanut butter and jelly, my grandfather said.
I glanced over to find that he had picked up my spilled cards and dealt.
Cheater, I didn't see you deal those, I said, reaching up to pull down a second bowl.
He spread his palms over his chest, making a show of innocence.
Cheater? I'm an innocent old man, he said.
Uh-huh, I said, carrying the bowls to the table and setting one in front of him. Redeal, old man.
He swept the cards together and shuffled, chuckling as I blew into my bowl to cool it off, keeping one eye on the kitten the whole time. I'd treated these people horribly. I'd refused to speak to them, refused to be pleasant. I'd said awful things to my grandmother, and her only response had been to tell me she loved me. My grandfather had invited me to play with him. They understood even when I was being unfair and selfish and ugly. They'd acted like family, like they were offering a place to belong. I just had to take it. My grandfather started laying cards out on the table again.
As if I need to cheat, he blustered, against a girl with purple hair.
Chapter 28. As dire as the sky had looked the day before, it looked that much brighter the next morning, as if the sun were trying to make up for lost opportunity. For the first time since arriving at my grandparents' house, I awoke without one of them waking me, a shaft of sunlight warm across my face, like a caress. The night before, after Grandpa Barry and I had played spit and then three hands of rummy, I'd made brownies from a box I found in the back of the pantry. I'd placed the plate of brownies on the table between us and poured two glasses of milk. I taught him how to play seven bridge, and he won the first game, which included a lot of crowing and laughter on his part. I blamed the loss on distraction. How was I supposed to concentrate on the cards with the kitten in the center of the table? Grandpa Barry was good at keeping me from brooding. We chatted about places that had the best ice cream, whether or not soccer was a boring sport. Books we'd read, and the Waverly Theater Company, which he thought had a summer program that I could get involved with if I wanted. Not one word about storms or tornadoes or my freakout or the way I'd been acting or the lifelong grudge my mother had held against them. Just brownies and milk and cards. And for a few minutes, none of that reminded me of Mom or Marin. When I realized that I had spent time not thinking about them, I instantly felt guilty. I tried to call up their faces in my mind. They were fuzzy, but they were still there. I imagined their voices as they spoke to me. I was pretty sure I could remember those. I told myself that eating brownies and playing cards wasn't going to make them deader.
It wasn't like a bowl of macaroni and cheese with my grandfather meant I was forgetting they ever existed. I pulled myself out of bed, showered and dressed, then padded into the kitchen where my grandmother sat over a newspaper, a pen in her hand. She looked surprised to see me, but didn't say a word as I passed by. I tried to act as if everything was totally normal between us, going to the fridge to grab a cup of yogurt I'd seen in there the night before. I sat across from her and ripped the top off of my yogurt. "Where's Grandpa Barry?" "He went into town to pick up a few yard supplies. Got some fertilizing to do this weekend," she said. She leaned over and wrote something into a crossword. "He going to be gone long?" I spooned yogurt into my mouth, my heart beating, knowing what I was about to ask. "Oh, a little while," she said. "You never know with him. He runs into people and gets talking. How come?" I swallowed. "I thought maybe we could go to Elizabeth today. I've never seen my mom's grave." I let the words fall between us, my stomach sinking further the longer she took to respond. She lifted her chin, tapped her pen to it a few times, looked out the window. "Well, I don't know if he'll be back in time to go." "Just the two of us," I said. "Me and you." Almost instantly, the end of my grandmother's nose bloomed red. I only noticed it because that was something that always happened to my mom, too. The moment she even thought about crying, her nose would redden, starting with the tip. "I need to put on some decent clothes," she said. "I can do that right now." I could tell she was making an effort to not look as hopeful and eager as she felt. I let out a breath I hadn't realized I was holding. "Okay." She pushed away from the table, leaving the crossword right where it was, then hurried out of the kitchen. From the living room, she called, "We can have lunch at Ori's. It was one of Chrissy's favorites." "Sure," I said after a pause, and even though I still felt all kinds of uncertain, something about the day ahead felt right, too. She left a note on the kitchen table for Grandpa Barry, and we got in the car. I watched out the window as we pulled through town. "Is that the high school?" I asked, pointing to a brick building about half the size of my school. "Yes, ma'am," she said. "But your grandfather and I have been talking. If you'd like to stay at your school for senior year, we'd certainly understand. We've got a little money put aside and are willing to use it to rent a place in Elizabeth for the school year. It won't be home, and we probably will need to come back to Waverly on the weekends to tend to the house, but we want you to be happy." "Really?" "Of course. Chrissy wouldn't have wanted you to be uprooted your senior year. They're saying your school will be rebuilt by August. Can you believe it?" I shook my head. I almost couldn't believe anything at this point. The thought of getting to spend senior year with my friends, at our favorite places to hang out, in the lighting booth and on the stage, made me feel somehow whole again. "Thank you," I breathed. "Thank you so much. We can come back every weekend. I won't mind." "Well, some weekends you might want to stay if you have things to do with your friends and Elizabeth," she said. "But we'll work it all out." It didn't make sense. How could the grandparents Mom had told us were so horrible be the kind of people who'd be willing to move to another city so their grandchild wouldn't have to go to a new school? How could oppressive and judgmental people never say anything less than a kind word to me, even when I hadn't been kind to them? I'd never questioned Mom. Never. But it didn't add up. The things she'd said about Barry and Patty were, well, they seemed wrong. And did it really matter anymore anyway? Mom was gone. My grandparents were all I had. We drove a little while longer, until I couldn't take it anymore. "What happened?" I blurted out as we turned onto the highway. She glanced at me, then changed lanes. "What do you mean?" "What happened between you guys and my mom? Why did she hate you so much? She told us you disowned her." My grandmother's hands wrapped tightly around the steering wheel, her eyes locked straight ahead. She hesitated, and for a moment I worried that nobody would ever tell me what had happened. I would never know the truth. "We did," she finally said. She got mixed up with Clay. His whole family was a mess, a bunch of criminals and drunks. We told her that we didn't approve and that she couldn't see him. But Chrissy was so strong-willed, always had been, ever since she was a toddler. I thought about my mom. I had hated arguing with her because there was no winning. When Mom got her mind set on something, it was going to happen whether you liked it or not, no matter how much begging and pleading you did. It was good to be reminded that some of the things I knew about her were absolute truths. Anyway, my grandmother continued, she started dating him, and next thing we knew, she was getting in trouble, too, ending up in jail. Once, she got arrested for taking off her bikini top and throwing it up on stage at a concert. She was so drunk, she didn't even care that she was topless. We tried putting our foot down, but she pushed back harder, found ways to be with him no matter what we did. He had a hold on her like we'd never seen before. So you disowned her because she wouldn't listen to you? No, she said. She got pregnant, but she was still doing all the same old destructive things. We got worried. About you, Jersey. We were afraid she was going to hurt you. So we tried to get her some counseling, but she said if we insisted, she would run away and marry Clay. We told her if she did, she might as well never come back. And she ran away. And she never came back. But you told her she couldn't. My grandmother glanced at me. If there was one thing we wished we'd never said, that would be it. We immediately began searching for her, but she'd moved out of Waverly and we had no idea where she'd gone. When we finally found her in Elizabeth, she'd already had you. We were so excited and ready to put everything behind us. But he still had such a hold over her. She wouldn't come home. And she called the police, so we left. And we worried so much about you, but Chrissy wouldn't budge. She loved him, and the way she saw it, we were the enemy. These things didn't sound like Mom, and I had a hard time imagining her turning her own parents away in favor of that disgusting man I'd met in Castor City. But they split up eventually, I said. Why didn't she come back after he left? I don't know, my grandmother said. I really don't. We sent some letters, some packages over the years, but we never heard anything back. We worry that we gave up too easily. Like I said, if only we could do it all over again. The kittens came from you. She paused, then nodded. Yes. You got them. I opened Marin's purse and pulled the black and white kitten out and held it up. She glanced at it several times, trying to keep her eye on traffic. This is the only one that survived the tornado. I thought they came from Clay. They were from us. Chrissy had a set. She loved them, and they were the best way we could reach out to you and let her know that we still loved her, too. They were our way of saying we were thinking about you both the whole time, she said, and praying that you were okay. All those years, Mom and I were alone. I'd grown up believing that our aloneness was something that had happened to us, something we had to prevail over. But really, it was only something that had happened to me. Mom had wanted it, and she had not given me a choice in the matter. And all the time, there was this family out there wondering about me, caring about me, wishing me safe and imagining what my life was like, and giving me a place to belong in their hearts, even if I never showed up there. But now, here I was. And it was up to me whether I wanted to claim my spot. What was my mom like when she was my age? I asked. Before she met Clay, I mean. My grandmother smiled wistfully. She was a ball of fire, independent, outgoing. She was a cheerleader in junior high, you know. I blinked. Mom, a cheerleader? I tried to picture her hopping around in a short dress, waving pom-poms. I couldn't do it. She always thought she was going to be a hairstylist, my grandmother continued.
One time in elementary school, she cut her own bangs, chopped them so short the other kids teased her mercilessly. They called her T-Square for months. But Chrissy didn't care. She was the kind of person who was going to do what she wanted. The whole world be damned.
She pretty much stayed that way, I said. And then, thinking about Marin's relentless begging for me to dance with her, added, my sister was like that too. My grandmother glanced at me, her mouth turned down at the corners.
I wish I'd met her, she said. And I couldn't help thinking that Marin would have liked our grandparents.
Yeah, I said softly. We drove along for a while longer. I held the kitten in my lap, stroking its side with my thumb. Are there other relatives? I asked, breaking the silence. Like cousins and stuff.
Yes, she said. I have a sister and a brother. Barry has two brothers, but they're all in St. Louis, where we both grew up. Maybe we'll take a ride out there someday, she said.
Then amended almost shyly. If you want. I didn't know if I wanted to do that or not. I was curious, but this felt like it was all happening so fast. I shrugged. Someday, I said. If you grew up in St. Louis, why are you here?
To me, St. Louis seemed so much more exciting than Waverly.
And as we drove along the highway toward Elizabeth, my grandmother told me stories about my family. She talked about how she met my grandfather and their move from St. Louis to Waverly and everything that led up to having my mom. She told me more things about my mom, that she hated being an only child and asked Santa for a baby sister every year, that she could swim like a fish and do splits in both directions, and that, before she started smoking, she could outrun every girl in her class, and most of the boys, too. And then she talked about Clay's family, how they were notorious throughout Waverly as being a nuisance, how they always had so many babies around you wondered where they all came from, but there was never any mistaking a Cameron baby because they all looked alike. We all looked alike. Before I knew it, we were driving up the exit into Elizabeth, all at once the surroundings looking familiar and unfamiliar to me, as if I'd been gone forever. This part of town had been untouched by the tornado, and other than a few downed trees, you would never have guessed that anything unusual had happened here. We stopped at a grocery store and bought flowers to put on the graves. I picked out pink carnations for Marin's because the florist had sprinkled glitter across them. I knew how much Marin had loved pink and sparkles. My grandmother bought red roses because those represented love. We shared memories and picked out the perfect flowers, and by the time we reached the cemetery, my mom and sister were in some ways more alive to me than they'd ever been.
Chapter 29. We both stopped talking as we drove through the cemetery. There was a very somber feeling about being there. So somber I almost felt a buzzing in my ears. Someone was being buried near the entrance. The mourners' dresses fluttered in the breeze as they stood with their heads bowed. Everywhere I looked, it seemed there were mounds of new dirt, new graves. My grandmother had told me that the final death count from the tornado was 129. 129 lives stolen. Only two of them from me. It seemed so weird to think of so many families grappling with the same sadness I'd been wrestling. This was the only cemetery in Elizabeth, so most of them were likely buried here.
Let me see, my grandmother said as she turned right down one of the little side roads that snaked deeper into the cemetery. I think it's over by that fence back there.
I gazed out the window, trying to find two fresh mounds near the fence, swallowing against the lump in my throat. This was where they were, my mom and my sister. This was where they would be forever. The finality of their deaths hit me on a whole different level. This wasn't temporary. They were really gone. They were never coming back. At the end of this nightmare, there would be no happy reunion. Finally, my grandmother put the car in park and turned it off. She let her hands rest in her lap,
gazing down at them for a few minutes. The only sound in the car was the crinkle of the plastic around the flowers as I squeezed them tighter.
You ready? She asked.
I turned back toward the window. The two graves were obvious now that we were near them.
As ready as I'll ever be, I said.
We got out and traipsed toward the fence line. I read some of the names on the headstones, not recognizing a single one, and idly wishing that there were at least one person nearby that Mom would have known. Someone to keep her company. But I guessed she had Marin for that. I clutched the flowers so tight my fingers ached. Marin's purse bumped along my side.
They don't have headstones yet, my grandmother said as we got closer, but it was as if she wasn't really talking to me so much as she was talking to herself. I hope he bought her one, at least.
I couldn't imagine Ronnie not buying them headstones, but who knew what Ronnie would do and not do these days? After all, I'd never have guessed he'd abandon me. Boy, did he ever surprise me with that one. We stopped walking, and even though I suddenly didn't want to, was suddenly terrified to, I had no choice but to look at their final resting place. I turned my eyes forward, expecting to be hit by an onslaught of sadness, maybe even weakness, grief pulling me to my knees. But it was just dirt. Two splotches of dirt in an otherwise grassy field, one splotch of dirt much longer than the other. My mom and Marin were under there somewhere, but these splotches of dirt weren't them. Now that I was here, I wasn't even sure why I expected them to be. My grandmother sniffed lightly, and I caught movement out of the corner of my eye, which might have been her wiping her eyes, but I was too riveted to the dirt mounds to pay her much attention.
They're gone, I said.
The obvious. Ronnie sent me away before the funerals. I didn't get to say goodbye, and now it's too late because they're gone.
I didn't get to either.
She paused for a really long time. Then finally,
but I like to think they knew I loved them, even if Marin didn't know me.
But I never got to say it. I never told them. She sniffed again and then said, her voice louder with resolve,
you can tell them now.
I turned to her.
But I can't. I don't know how.
My grandmother looked like she was slowly melting. She tried to keep it in, but her face jiggled and wobbled and soon crumpled in completely. She nodded, letting out a sob.
I know, she said. And I don't know how to help you. I feel like the only thing I can offer my daughter after all these years is to help you let her go, and I can't do it. How can I when I'm not ready to let her go myself?
I stood awkwardly in front of her. I hated that she was crying, but this whole grandmother and granddaughter thing was so new to me, and I was such a volcano of conflicting feelings myself, always feeling so near eruption I barely wanted to move. I bent my knees and dropped the flowers on the ground, then stood up again. Slowly I opened Marin's purse, then unzipped the small compartment inside. The foils shone at me as if they were lit from within rather than reflecting sunlight. I scooped them out and held them in my palm, offering them to my grandmother. She sniffled some more, blinking and calming down as she tried to understand what I was giving her.
What's this?
She said, pulling a crumpled tissue out of her pants pocket and wiping her cheeks with it. I licked my lips.
This is Marin, I said.
Slowly, with shaky hands, she reached out and plucked a foil out of my palm. She unfolded it, looking uncertain.
Marin loves scorpions, she read.
She flicked a curious glance at me, then reached out and took another.
Marin is a monkey.
And even though my drawings couldn't possibly have made sense to her, she took another and then another, reading each one aloud, sometimes laughing a wet laugh and sometimes unable to finish the sentence for the tears in her voice. She met her other granddaughter that way, one chewed up memory at a time. We sat down on the ground together at my mom's feet, the purse open between us so my grandmother could put the foils down without their blowing away. I explained some of them,
The same way she told me about my mom's cut bangs and swimming prowess, I told her about Marin's peach-colored leotard and about the East Coast swing. I picked at the petals of one of Mom's roses as I talked, and my grandmother cried and asked questions and laughed and interjected and cried some more. Finally, when we were both talked and cried out, I turned onto my knees and placed the bouquets of flowers on each grave, wiping dirt that had gotten stuck on my palms onto the sides of my shirt. I assessed how the flowers looked, and then, struck by a moment of bravery, I decided that if I was on my knees anyway, I might as well give talking to my mom a try. At last. Chapter 30. My grandfather had said that to pray was to speak from my heart. So that's exactly what I did. I pressed my palms together and closed my eyes, feeling shaky and nervous and self-conscious. I talked silently in my head so my grandmother couldn't hear what I had to say. We had started to get to know each other, but that didn't mean I wanted her to know everything. I still wanted to keep some things to myself. "Hey, God," I said. "I know you're keeping Mom and Marin safe up there and everything, and I'm really glad about that. I'm sure they were scared when they got to you, so thanks for taking care of them." I took a breath and squeezed my palms together tighter. I'm not sure how to do this, but I'd really kind of like to talk to my mom, if that's okay. I haven't gotten to say anything to her since she died. My knees pressed into the soft ground, and I let my butt sink slowly to rest on the backs of my legs. I squeezed my eyes tight, like I'd done before, and tried to picture Mom's face in my mind. And just when I thought the image would never come, it did. She was smiling at me, laughing maybe. There was sunlight highlighting the top of her head, and she was wearing that ridiculous pair of sunglasses that I'd always made fun of because they were so huge. I felt such love radiating off her. The words poured out of my heart. "Hi, Mom," I said in my head. "I'm sorry you haven't heard from me until now. I didn't know how to talk to you at first, and I was afraid that if I started talking to you, it would mean you were really dead. Which is stupid, of course, because you've been really dead all along. I've just had a hard time believing it. So, I guess you've seen everything that's happened since you died, all the stuff with Ronnie and Clay and Lexi and Meg. I'm not gonna lie, Mom, it's been hard and scary. And every day I wish I had died with you. Not that I'm suicidal or anything, so you don't need to worry about that. Just that I wish I hadn't been left behind all alone. That part really sucks. But I've learned a few things, like that Ronnie loved you so much he can't live without you, which even though it hurt me, is kind of cool in a way. And that Clay is maybe the worst man on earth, and I will never, ever be stuck in the same room with him again. At first, I didn't understand why you lied to me about him leaving us, and I felt really betrayed. I thought everything I knew about you might have been a lie, but since meeting him and your parents, I've realized that the parts of you I knew weren't untrue, they were only part truths. There were lots of things about you that I didn't know, and learning those things has actually been comforting in a way. They make me feel closer to you. And I can see that actually there's one real truth, and that is you loved me enough to do anything it took to protect me. I think that's something I've known my whole life. I'm thankful for it. Grandma Patty and Grandpa Barry. Well, they're not so bad, Mom. Maybe I just haven't seen the bad side of them yet, and maybe someday I will, and I'll totally understand all the things you said about them, but right now I don't feel like I have to hold my breath when I'm around them as much, which is good because they're my only choice. I think about you all the time. You and Marin both, but mainly you. I remember all the stuff we did together and the little moments when you did awesome things like get us out of bed to go get ice cream or buy us snowboards, or that time you read the entire Harry Potter series out loud to us. It took you like 6 months, but you never complained. Do you remember that time you took me to the water park? Just me, because Marin wasn't born yet and you hadn't even met Ronnie. I think I was in third grade, maybe.
You wore your red polka-dotted swimsuit, and I had that bikini with the stripes that I hated because it made me feel fat. Anyway, we went to the water park, and we rode that huge slide. I think it was called the Slippery Cyclone. Remember how you had to talk and talk to get me on it? I was so scared. That slide was so tall, and the pool at the end looked so deep, and I wasn't sure if I could touch the bottom. I was afraid something would happen to me if I sat down and let myself go. But worse than that, I was afraid something would happen to you. That you'd fly off into the woods and smash onto the rocks below, or that the slide would cave in and crush you, or that you'd just never come down, and I'd be treading water at the bottom of that slide forever and ever, waiting for you, waiting for those red and white polka dots to swoosh around that last corner. That's how I feel now, Mom. Like I'm treading water and you're not coming down the slide. I can't touch the bottom here, and I'm scared. I want you back. There are some things I never got to say. I'm sorry, Mom, for all the times I got mad and was mean to you. I'm sorry about the time I told you I hated you because you wouldn't let me go to Jane's house on Ronnie's birthday. I'm sorry I didn't tell you I loved you when you took Marin to dance the night of the tornado. If I had to do it all over again, I would like to say I'd take all those things back, but I don't know if I would. We were close. So close, sometimes we screamed at each other, and I've been thinking that maybe those things were just different sides of the same coin. When we were screaming hateful things, it was only because we were feeling loving things. I don't know. Maybe that sounds stupid. But I like to think that way because it makes me feel as if even though I didn't show it sometimes, you still knew how much I loved you. I've been thinking a lot about the word everything. Whenever something horrible happens, you hear people say they lost everything. They lost their house or their car or their stuff or whatever, and to them it feels like everything. But they have no idea what it's really like to lose everything. I thought I knew, but now I realize even I haven't lost everything because I still have that polka dot swimsuit in my memory. I still have those ice cream nights and the snowboards and the scorpion that scared Marin and the barking bulldog sweatshirt and the robin's egg blue nail polish. Somehow having those things makes the other stuff matter less. I'm wondering if it's even possible to lose everything or if you just have to keep redefining what everything is. Because I didn't know it before, but somehow Grandpa Barry and Grandma Patty fit into my everything now, and even if I'm not sure yet how they fit, they're there. I guess that's just my way of saying, you don't need to worry about me giving up. I'm just going to keep redefining everything for as long as I need to, because I'm pretty sure that's the best way to keep on going when you feel like you've lost it all. I've learned a lot of new things about you from a lot of different people, but one thing everyone agrees on is that you were headstrong. You were tough. You taught me how to be tough, too. You taught me how to tread water and how to swim out of the deep end. But I'll probably be looking for that red swimsuit for a while yet. I love you, Mom, and I miss you so much. Tell Marin I said I love her, too. And I miss the way she hums. Chapter 31. The first thing I carried into our Elizabeth duplex was a litter box. I'd set it in the laundry room closet and poured litter into it, hoping Swing would get the hang of it in our new place. She was a gray and white ball of trouble, or at least that's what my grandfather called her after the fourth or fifth time he had to pluck her from the top of the drapes, which she was forever climbing, and she still had blue eyes. My grandmother said eventually her eyes would turn gold, like other cats' eyes, but for now, the fuzz and the wide blue eyes made her so heartbreakingly cute I could barely stand it. Marin would have been over the moon with her. We had gone out and adopted the cat the day my grandparents found the duplex we'd be living in from August to May. She was our celebration. "What are you going to name her?" my grandmother had asked in the car on the way home, the little kitten mewing loudly in my lap. I stroked her head to calm her. I thought about how much Marin had wanted a cat, how she'd never even gotten one of the porcelain birthday kittens that I had gotten every year. I wanted to name this cat something important to Marin. "Swing," I said. EC swing.
Sounds fancy,
my grandfather had said, and I'd grinned. Marin would have loved a fancy name for a fancy cat. We officially moved in the week before school was supposed to start. Most of Elizabeth was still barely out of cleanup mode, just beginning to rebuild, and we were uncertain who all would be making it back for senior year. The library remained the place where everyone caught up, and as the first day grew nearer, more and more of us showed up there, taking over the parking lot. The librarians didn't appear to mind. They seemed to like being the place where the crippled community felt comfortable gathering again. I went with Danny a few times while my grandparents stayed at the duplex and got us settled. Jane was still in Kansas City, and it didn't look like her house would be rebuilt before school started, which meant she wouldn't be back for senior year. Danny and I would be a duo, and I wasn't sure how we would do without Jane. We made her promise to visit a lot. 3 days before school started, Colby showed up in the library parking lot, his arm still wrapped in a weeping bandage. His sister Tracy, who seemed to have grown up so fast, hovered near him every step he took. At first, people stared and whispered, but then someone asked him about it, and when he told the story, girls cried and people called him a badass, and he smiled, relaxed. I sidled up to him. "I'm really sorry," I said.
"About what?"
I pointed at his arm. "I didn't clean it good enough." He held it up and shrugged.
"It's not your fault, Jersey," he said. "It's nobody's fault. It is what it is. The whole thing is what it is."
"Did it hurt?" He shrugged again, shook his head, then grinned and nodded.
"Like 10,000 mothers," he said. "Not as bad anymore, though. But at first it was wicked, and I was pissed off."
"Yeah," I said. "I know the feeling." In some ways, it was like Colby and I were both nursing the same infection, only mine was on the inside. We were both healing, but not without the scars to remind us that the cut, deep and painful, had been there. Some girls came by and told him they were inspired by his story, and Colby kind of ate it up a little bit, the good old Colby I'd always known. After they left, his mom pulled up to the curb and honked, ducking and bobbing her head to find him in the crowd. He bumped my shoulder with his.
"So, admit it. I have a pretty nice ass, don't I?"
he joked, holding his arm up and waving it in front of me. I couldn't help laughing. "You're disgusting," I said. But I was happy to see that what had happened to him hadn't broken his stride any, and hadn't changed things between us.
"Come on, Colby, we gotta go," Tracy said, heading toward the car.
He started after her, then turned back.
"I'm glad you came back to Elizabeth," he said, "'cause there's something I want to ask you."
"What?" He held out his arm and pointed to the bandage.
"How do you feel about guys with scars? Pretty hot, right?"
I laughed, a little tingling sensation in my chest, and nodded. "Definitely hot." I tugged at my hair. "That is, if you care what purple-haired chicks think."
"I was hoping you'd feel that way," he smirked. "And I like the purple. Makes your eyes stand out."
Quickly, he bent and kissed me on the cheek, then strode to his mom's car without missing a beat.
"I'll call you," he said as he ducked inside.
Later that night, when Danny's mom dropped me off at the duplex, I found my grandmother pushing the couch out of the way against the wall in the living room.
"Oh, good. I'm glad you're home," she said when she saw me.
She bent and fiddled with a little CD player that had been in their garage back in Waverly.
"What's up?"
I asked. Music started to pour out of the speakers, and my grandmother twisted the volume knob to make it louder. Swing swatted at the power cord, which hung down the back of a little table. My grandmother turned and held her arms out as horns started playing in the background. "What's—" I asked again. But then it dawned on me what she was doing. She began to bob, bending her knees up and down to the time of the music.
"May I have this dance?" she asked, and I laughed out loud.
"Sure, why not?" I said. I kicked off my shoes and dropped Marin's purse next to the front door and went to her. When Marin was born, my mom told me that family had nothing to do with blood, but only had to do with what was in your heart. I felt sad for her that she'd cut her family, my grandparents, out of her heart.
and I felt sad that she'd left me with a heart so empty of family. Without her, I had been confused and lonely, unsure who I belonged to. Clay was right. He wasn't my family because I wasn't in his heart. But my grandparents' hearts were open. I still didn't know when or how far I could open my own heart, but I knew that if I wanted the family I'd never had, all I needed to do was open up and let them in. My grandmother enveloped me in her arms, perfecting our form, and then slowly moved her feet for me to follow.
"Bet you didn't know your sister's dance genes were inherited," she said.
I stumbled, frowned. "I think I missed that gene." Suddenly, she whisked me into a twirl, and I giggled. When we were face to face again, she raised her eyebrows.
"That's why you have me," she said.
And she taught me the East Coast Swing, both of us humming along happily. Author's note. On a late Sunday afternoon in May 2011, the city of Joplin, Missouri, was hit by a deadly EF5 tornado. The twister was nearly a mile wide and carved a 6-mile gash through the city, the 200-mile-per-hour winds destroying everything in their path. Homes were leveled and businesses devastated, causing billions of dollars in damage. More than 150 people died. Many others lost everything. For months, I had been scheduled to speak at the Joplin Public Library. My appearance was supposed to happen just weeks after the tornado, in late July. Of course, upon seeing the news coverage of the tornado, I was sure my program would be canceled. Who could expect the people of a ravaged town to have time for an author event? I emailed the librarian, telling her that my thoughts and prayers were with them and I'd be happy to reschedule whenever they were ready. How shocked I was when I received a response just days later informing me that the show was to go on. "Our community needs this," she told me. Joplin is not a long drive from my town of Liberty, only 165 miles or so. As I drove the 2.5 hours, I couldn't help thinking what a very short distance those 165 miles would be for a tornado. Had things shifted only slightly, had the tornado raged north for another couple of hours, it could have been my town that was destroyed. I could have been one of the people who lost everything. A study by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration discovered that many Joplin residents failed to heed the tornado warnings that day because they'd become desensitized to the sound of tornado warning sirens. I get it. I've lived my whole life in the Midwest. Tornado watches and warnings are a way of life. I don't want to say we don't take them seriously, but when you get so many of them, you can become complacent, and complacency can be deadly. Just like Jersey, who didn't want her cooking to be interrupted, you sometimes get skeptical or lazy or just too darn busy to be inconvenienced by what you imagine will be yet another false alarm. Sometimes you just assume disaster is never going to happen to you. How could the people of Joplin have foreseen what was going to happen to them on May 22nd? After my library visit in Joplin, I took a tour of the devastated area. Even after weeks of cleanup, the destruction was knee-buckling. Whole houses gone. Street signs and other landmarks gone. Trees gone. Everything just gone. I was speechless, and my heart ached for the people who had lost so much. But even more shocking than what I saw in the tornado's path outside was what I saw inside the library that day. It was busy, bustling, and a full crowd turned out for my event. I couldn't believe that in the midst of tragedy, people were still dedicated to living their previously scheduled lives. The librarian was right. The community did need the show to go on, not necessarily to hear me speak, but to do something normal, to do something planned, to be with one another, to laugh and smile, to show that they may have been down, but they were definitely not out. Far from it. After what I saw in Joplin, I began to think about what it means to lose everything. Everyone has his or her own version of a tornado. Fire, earthquake,
hurricane, tsunami, war, illness, terror attack. An unexpected disaster rages. Someone loses everything.
But is it really possible to lose absolutely everything? Can we lose our spirit? Can we lose our drive? Can we lose whatever it is that makes us continue in the face of overwhelming adversity? Can we really lose that uniquely human ability to hope? Or is it possible to step up to the enormous task of redefining everything? These were the questions I wanted to put to Jersey Cameron. I wanted to strip her of absolutely everything and see what she did with the bare bones that were left. I had a feeling she could answer the call to adversity with strength and integrity, and in the end, I think she did. Her path wasn't easy or straightforward, and she wasn't without her hiccups and undignified moments, but the point was that she kept going, she kept fighting, she kept trying to remember what and where her everything was. Every so often I think about those people in Joplin who came to hear me speak. I can still picture some of their faces. They were grim but open. They were tired but interested. If ever there was a visible spark of hope, it was in that room. I imagine Jersey sitting among the crowd, her own face grim and weary, her own spark of hope glimmering behind her eyes, her own redefinition of everything writing itself on her heart. This audiobook is for all of those in Joplin who showed me firsthand what survivor spirit looks like, and for the countless others out there who have suffered devastation and tragedy and have managed to build on. It is for all of you who unexpectedly have found yourselves forced to redefine what everything means to you. To those of you called to rebuild a life you didn't plan on living, and did it anyway. Thank you for listening to Jersey's story. Jennifer.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Torn Away, written by Jennifer Brown, read by Lauren Fortgang, produced and directed by Christine M. Farrell, recorded by Tommy Herron, post-production by Chris Candio. Torn Away is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2014 by Jennifer Brown. Audio production copyright 2014, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.